You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 69, Leviticus 6 and 7. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Good to be back with you, Trey.
Yeah, I'm still recovering from the last show.
Yeah, well, I hope folks seem to like the interviews, and we like doing them. So I don't think this one's going to be, or that one's going to be any different in the long run. I think people will really find that fascinating. People who find it, you know, now that it's been out for a while, they're going to find it later. And I'm just willing to bet that that one's going to have a long lifespan.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a subject matter that normally doesn't get any light on it. So I'm glad we're doing it.
Yep. Well, back to the humdrum world of Leviticus, I guess. So I shouldn't say that because I got an email from someone that said, quit apologizing for doing Leviticus.
Yeah, really? I mean, it is interesting and it's much needed.
So whoever that is, you can consider me rebuked. So I'll try to remember that. Well, Leviticus 6 and 7 today, and these two chapters are sort of going to be dipping back into the first five chapters in some respects. Again, obviously we've covered the offerings, you know, the major offerings up to this point. First five chapters, we had the whole burnt offering, which, you know, listeners will recall was a gift that was brought to God. Again, want to spend time with God, so we bring God a gift. A peace offering we talked about, the grain offering, the quote-unquote sin offering, which, again, per our discussion, we really recommended referring to it as the decontamination offering. And then the guilt offering we talked about most recently. And again, for, I think, a better way of terming it or referring to it was the reparation or the restitution offering. So Leviticus 6 and 8, you get these two chapters, they're going to sort of present the, not necessarily the procedural rules, but they're going to present the quote-unquote law for each of these types of sacrifices. So the first five chapters did was essentially emphasize kind of the mechanics, the ritual mechanics of it, the preparation of the sacrifices, their ingredients, do this with this part and that with the other part, that sort of thing. These two chapters really focus on the role of the priesthood as those who officiate in the sanctuary, and then detail things to do that attend, again, are a part of bringing the sacrificial offerings in order to prevent impurity. Another way you could say it, and I'm going to be tracking through Levine for a good part of this. I'll try to remember to refer to him when I'm doing that. But these two chapters will specify, again, what to do with certain portions, especially what to allocate to the priest. And we've had a little of that, you know, before, because first five chapters mentioned in passing, this is the part that goes for God. This is the part that is kept for the priest. But you get a little more of that in these two chapters. What's sort of unique to these two chapters, those 6 and 7, is the little glimpse they give us of the system whereby the priests partook of sacred meals within the boundaries of the sanctuary. So, except for the burnt offering, I mean, think of it this way, except for the burnt offering of chapter 1, Leviticus 1, and the grain offering that we're going to see a little bit here in chapter 6, and then the decontamination offering from Leviticus 4, the quote-unquote sin offering. Most sacrifices were actually meant to be eaten, and typically by priests, and on occasion by the people who brought them. So Leviticus 6 and 7 gets into a little bit more about how to parse that, you know, who eats, what can you eat, that kind of thing, which, you know, sounds kind of odd, sounds kind of boring, but, I mean, think about it. Here you have a system of different sacrifices. And we typically think, again, evangelicals, Christians, whatever, Christians of any variety, you know, think of the sacrificial system as, you know, lots of blood and slaughter, and we again filter it through the work of the cross, and how all of this is about forgiveness of sins, and these animals have to die, and whatnot. And it feels like just this slaughtering waste, you know, like a waste of these animals, but it's actually not. Most of what is offered, again, was consumed, eaten by someone, again, except for those exceptions that I just listed. So it's not just this wanton waste of animal life. I mean, you're going to, you know, be eating livestock anyway in the ancient world, but, you know, specifically to the sacrificial system, it has a lot to do with, again, who is eating what, who's participating, who's not, and again, what parts and that sort of thing. So it's not, again, just this total waste. And I think it's worth us thinking about this system, which was very careful to distinguish who gets to eat some of it and who doesn't, and who gets to eat what parts and all that sort of stuff, because some is for God, some is not. And then you have all these issues of impurity. I'm hoping that people, you know, this question pops in their head. Does this have any relationship to communion? You know, to the Lord's table. And I think conceptually it does, with one sort of important twist. You know, think about communion. You have bread and wine. Well, the bread, you know, this is my body. Again, the wine, this is my blood. And I think there is a correspondence there between, again, grain offering, again, because that's how what you make bread out of ultimately, and meat, you know, for the offering, again, the flesh. And you have a sacred meal. But in the Old Testament, there were very strict rules about that. And most of the time, it was just really the priests. Occasionally, the people who were sort of connected to the sacrifice because they brought it, because they either wanted to commune with God or they had some problem, like need of restitution, or they had committed, again, either in most cases unintentionally, they'd done something that rendered them ritually impure, so they had to be decontaminated and all that. Occasionally, they got to participate, but most of the time, the common person did not. Well, look at the analogy. I mean, if there is indeed, again, this sacrificial analogy between the Old Testament system and the work of Christ, the communion idea makes a lot of sense, even if it includes everyone. It includes all believers, not just priests, not just a priestly class or an elite class or anything like that. Why? Because in New Testament theology, all believers are priests, priesthood of the believer. Okay, you are God's temple. You are a holy priesthood, and it's egalitarian. It's everyone included. So if you're a Jew, again, you know, put yourself in the context. If you're a Jewish person and you're familiar with, you know, the ritual system, either because you were taught it or you saw parts of it in the Second Temple, you know, around New Testament times, you're familiar with this, you know, the inner workings of this, and you know that participation in the meal sense is pretty much basically going to exclude you because you're not a priest. Well, when, you know, you have the apostles, you know, coming along and preaching and in Paul's case, writing about this stuff, where it basically says, no, we're all priests. We all get to partake of the sacred meal now, okay, because it commemorates the flesh, you know, the Lord's body, which was broken for you. And again, his death, you know, this is the, you know, the cup of the New Testament, you know, the new covenant here, you know, this is my blood, so on and so forth. I mean, we all get to partake of that because we're all priests. We're all sort of on equal footing. That would have been very striking, again, to a Jew who's introduced, again, by the apostles, by apostolic preaching, or by a letter from one of the apostles that we have in our New Testament, to these ideas, because before they would have been quite restricted, but now they're not. So again, what we're going to read here in Leviticus 6 and 7, I'm actually going to just pick a few spots here, more or less talk about the two chapters conceptually, but there will be parts of this that just, you know, you can see are, you know, an interesting analogy. Another part of it would be where in this system, the priests, again, receive their portions, again, in return, it's a payment. So in return for their services on behalf of the Israelite people, this is why they get to eat part of the sacrifices, because this is like income to them. This is part of their sustenance. So what does that tell us? You know, you have essentially instruction that illustrates the rule that priests, again, had to be compensated. It's kind of interesting that the high priest in Leviticus 6, around verses 19 to 23, could not be compensated for sacrifices performed on his own behalf. You know, just a little exception there. So he could only do it for services rendered to others. But nevertheless, this is a payment. Now, isn't it kind of interesting when Paul comes along, again, he's the guy writing a lot of this believer priest kind of thing. Paul comes along and does not insist on being supported by the congregations that he starts. Now, he says, I could insist on you know, the labor's, you know, worthy of his hire. I could make a demand here and so on and so forth. But instead, you know, he goes out and he gets a job. You know, he supports himself. But this whole notion that, again, he, as an apostle, is really not a priest. Because if he thought of himself as a priest in the terms of an elite, distinct from the rest of the community of believers, this probably would have been a bigger deal. You know, he would have made it sort of a right, you know, sort of a you know, he would have made the demand, but he says, no, I could do that. And the laborer is worthy of his hire, but I'm not going to be a burden to you. So even though conceptually all believers are priests, you know, the way Paul sort of reinforces that point is to deny that priests, you know, the priesthood is something special by again, getting a job and not insisting on being sustained like the Old Testament priests were. And again, that is kind of interesting because I think that puts the whole idea of, quote, having all things in common from Acts chapter 2 in a different light as well, because it sort of makes sense. Well, we don't do what we do. We don't have to, you know, we're not forced to support this one person or this small group of people. We're not forced to do that. We're going to do it voluntarily, but they're telling us that we should have all things in common. And again, that makes sense if everybody's a priest. It's this mutual support. It's not the support of an elite class, you know, that that's sort of a different breed of Christian, you know, like the Levites, you know, and not even all Levites were priests, but the priests and the Levites, you know, they were marked off as being sort of a separate class of Israelite because they're the only ones that can occupy sacred space and do this or that ritual or care for the, you know, the vessels of the tabernacle and tear it down, put it back up, all that sort of thing. So they were in a special class, but all of that, you know, sort of disappears and becomes this mutual support kind of thing in the New Testament where everybody is, again, sort of classified as a priest. So it's kind of interesting to look at some things in the New Testament through, you know, opposite of what's typically done, but through the lens of the Old Testament rather than looking at the Old Testament through the lens of the New. It's kind of interesting to do it in reverse and just see the contrast. Because again, if you're a Jew, you're going to be used to this system. You're going to be used to this thinking, well, there's us and the priests, and we're not them and they're not us. And, you know, they're different. They're special. You know, they have, you know, they get closer to God than we do and they get to partake of this or that and we don't. Again, That's not on the table when it comes to the New Testament church. We mutually support each other. We don't make these kinds of demands. We all participate in the sacred meal because we're all priests. And it's just a totally different way of looking at things. Now, by way of actually jumping into the chapter, or chapters 6 and 7, they break down pretty easily. Again, for those who didn't listen to the last episode, not the interview, but the one before it, we actually got into chapter 6 a little bit because there's a difference in versification in the Hebrew Bible and the English Bible. So technically where we'll actually start today is really in the English Bible, Leviticus 6:8, but we'll just go back to the beginning to break this down. The first 16 verses of chapter 6 really deal with the whole burnt offering. And again, the meal offering, the grain offering, since they were part of the public cult. So they're talked about first. What we're going to find is that there's a series, kind of groupings of the offerings in these two chapters that are going to get commented in order. And they're going to really proceed from the most sacred public offerings on into sacred offerings that are sort of private worship, private matters. So the first 16 verses start off with the public rituals, the olah, burnt offering, and the mincha. And really, these offerings become, they're public because they often occur in conjunction with national events to mark special days or part of festivals. The Sabbath, again, coming of the Sabbath, that sort of thing, which concerned everybody. So Leviticus 6 again starts off talking about those, and then it transitions to the sin offering, again the decontamination offering, and the guilt offering, what we're calling the reparation or the restitution offering. And those two really aren't regular features of what scholars would call the public cult, you know, the public, you know, sacrificial proceedings. Instead, they're sort of expiation sacrifices, expiation rituals, usually performed by individual Israelites or on behalf of individual Israelites. Again, and that makes sense because if you have to bring a chatat, again, the sin offering, it's because you personally did something that rendered you impure. If you have to make restitution, well, that's a personal matter. So you that becomes, again, a personal situation, a personal sacrifice, as opposed to something that involves the whole community. So in Leviticus 6 and 7, those are sort of divvied out for, that's how they're literarily arranged. Talk about the public ones, talk about the private ones. You get into further into Leviticus 7, you have offerings that are sort of, in other parts of Leviticus, called less sacred. Again, these are, again, sort of personal worship offerings. They're less sacred because of the way they do or don't involve the priesthood, and, you know, if they're public or not. And then again, that's really the way the chapter ends. You know, parts of the sacrificial offerings that are shared by the priest. The last few verses of Leviticus 7 are, again, sort of divvying up the portions that the priests get. So chapter 6 and 7 are sort of an overview of, you know, who gets what's public, what's private, you know, that kind of thing. So it's just it's a rehearsal of what's gone on in the first five chapters, but just sort of looking at it from a different angle. Now, what I want to do is just drill down on a few points that I think are sort of interesting in these two chapters. And the first thing that we'll hit, I'll just read here in Leviticus 6:8, the beginning of our whole section for this episode. It says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Command Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the law of the burnt offering," and then so on and so forth. Well, this is the first time we get the word law, Torah, in Leviticus. And in these two chapters, Torah is going to occur seven times. So we might want to ask ourselves, well, why use this word here? Why didn't it show up earlier? What's the point? Well, Hebrew Torah is a noun, obviously, that derives from the root in Hebrew yara, which means to cast or to shoot. I think shoot's actually a better way to think about it, like shooting an arrow, for instance. Some dictionaries, again, those of you who are into Bible study and you actually use lexicons or theological word books or that sort of thing, some dictionaries will actually have two yaras, you know, they're homographs, one to shoot and the other one to show or indicate. Now, there are scholars who disagree about whether those are homographs or not. For our purposes, it doesn't really matter, because if you think about it, to shoot, sort of to aim and shoot, the abstract idea of yara, the verb, and hence the noun Torah, is to show something, to shoot at something, metaphorically, to aim at something, to direct attention toward. And that's actually what the verb yara means in the, sorry for the Hebrew lapse here, but in the hifil stem, which is the causative stem in Hebrew, it means to aim or direct toward, and hence the noun Torah means instruction, to show the way, to be shown what to do, you know, how to do something. And so, again, the Torah, the law here that we're going to read about in Leviticus 6 and 7 is really ultimately, as we said a few minutes ago, concerned with the priestly participation, the you know, the portions, what's done with them, that sort of thing. In verse 9, we keep reading the rest of that verse. Says, "This is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth on the altar all night until the morning, and the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it." So the fire here was not supposed to go out. And again, think about it. The burnt offering was the first sacrifice we talked about. It's sort of the initial one. When it's used in combinations with others, it sort of breaks the ice, so to speak. I want to spend time with the Lord, or I have a matter that I need to take up with the Lord. So the first thing we do is we bring a gift. Again, the whole burnt offering was a gift. Going to God's house, we're going to bring a housewarming gift, that sort of thing. And we talked about how the principle is that even on your best day, even if you don't have a, you know, an impurity issue that you have to get taken care of, or a reparation issue that you got to take care and get taken care of, even on your best day, it's still a fearful thing. There should be trepidation, there should be caution about approaching God's space, about going to God's house, that sort of thing. Well, here in verse 9, the daily burnt offering. And they would do one in the morning and another one in the evening. You can read about that in Exodus 29, 38, and so on, in Numbers 28. This is what it's talking about here in Leviticus 6, that in the morning we do one, in the evening we do one, and you're never supposed to let the fire on the altar of the burnt offering go out. And so, you know, why? What's the point? Well, again, you always want there to be, again, try to think abstractly, you always want to be you don't want the housewarming gift to sort of, the effect of that to sort of go away. You want there to be a good, you know, relationship between you and God. We don't want to let this fire go out because we're conscious of needing a good relationship, you know, with the Lord at all times, morning and evening, you know, 24/7, that sort of thing. And so it was designed to be a reminder of, again, bringing that gift to God's house, initiating contact with Him, and again, having Him accept that contact, accept the presence of human beings in His presence. And so the fire was supposed to be kept burning as, again, just a signal for that, to always be conscious of that. In verse 10, it says, "The priest shall put on his linen garment and put his linen undergarment on his body, and he shall take up the ashes to which the fire has reduced the burnt offering on the altar and put them beside the altar." Okay, so we have this sort of odd reference in the midst of this because, you know, while the fire is still burning, you got ashes, you got to take care of that issue. We're not going to get into the rules and regulations for that. But here we have this comment in verse 10 that I thought is kind of interesting. The priest, again, putting on this linen garment and his linen undergarment on his body. You say, well, what is that about? Well, it actually harkens back to something in Exodus 28. Exodus 28:42 says, "You shall make for them," again, instructions for the priestly garments in that chapter, "you shall make for them," for the priests, "linen undergarments to cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs." So there's actually a rule about wearing undergarments so that you're not exposed. You say, well, what? You know, who's going to run around lifting the, you know, lifting the priest's robes? Well, that actually wasn't the point because of the way the altar was made. If you go back even further in Exodus, that was Exodus 28:42. You go back even further in Exodus to Exodus 20, when the instructions for the altar are talked about, you read this in verses 25 to 26. "If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones, for if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness be not exposed on it." Now, we know from later times in Israelite history, there were steps that were part of the altar complex. And so this was actually a rule, a law that, you know, you don't want to go up because if people are sort of gathered around you, not only will your naked flesh, quote unquote, be exposed, which is, again, one of the reasons they give them linen undergarments, but also because people will see that. And there's some sense of indecency there, just on the surface. It's actually a little more involved in that because one of the contrasts to this in ancient Near Eastern religion, and we know this from ancient Near Eastern art, is that a lot of pagan rituals, pagan sacrifices in their temple complexes actually show priests officiating, doing their thing in the nude. And so there are a lot of scholars that think that part of the reasoning, other than just sort of regular decency, that kind of thing, part of the reason why this is a concern in Exodus and Leviticus is this contrast. You know, we're not going to do this like the pagans do. So we're not going to do anything that would smack of quote unquote ritual nudity. And we're going to see this later on. We've seen hints of it already about making it very clear that we don't have any sort of, any sort of fleshly, you know, sexual relationship with the priesthood between the people who are bringing offerings and the priests and what goes on, you know, in the temple complex. And again, a big part of that reasoning is what did go on in other temple complexes, especially when you get to things like the whole sacred marriage ritual, where the certain temple complexes in pagan religions would, for lack of a better term, either designate or employ, designates probably a better word, priests or priestesses to engage in sexual acts in the temple complex, typically, you know, sexual intercourse, because of the belief that, okay, you know, this is how the gods, you know, bring fertility to the crops, and this is how the gods do this or that, and so we're going to mime what they do so that, you know, our crops will grow and that sort of thing. So all that kind of association is sort of driven out of the Israelite cult, and even to the point now where the priests have to wear undergarments so that nobody sees their body parts. And again, so you have a decency issue there, and you also have, again, this contrast to what paganism is doing. And, you know, why should we care about our body parts, you know, below our waist or our genitals or something like that? Well, you know, in the ancient world, ritual nudity and this kind of thing was you know, associated with life. This is how you get living things, you know, through sexual copulation. And abstractly, you know, the gods would cohabit and then you'd get rain, you know, and all these kinds of beliefs. But it was associated with life and ultimately death and rebirth, these cycles. And so in pagan religions, you'll often have either rituals done in the nude or you'll have sexual acts performed with some sort of magical intent. Again, like I mentioned a few moments ago, that priests and priestesses would mime what they were thinking the gods were doing to cause things to grow or to cause, you know, the cycles of life and death and rebirth to continue. So when you're doing things here to imitate what you think the gods are doing and sort of to produce a desired effect, that's one of the definitions really of magic, sympathetic magic, to be more specific. And again, the Israelite sacrificial system sort of has these built-in prohibitions or obstacles, might be a better way to say it, to having people think in those terms about what's happening in the tabernacle or in the temple complex, what's happening with the sacrificial system. It has nothing to do, you know, with that, you know, sort of behavior, that sort of thing. So there are, again, just things like that that really are very clear contrastive elements if you were familiar with the way, you know, certain other pagan religions sort of do their sacrifices, at least some of them. So I thought that was a point of interest. Let's go down to verse 13, where we have here, again, another reference to a fire shall be kept burning on the altar continually. We have, again, in connection here with other offerings, again, the idea, the same thing, the perpetual fire on the altar. Again, especially now we have it associated in verse 12 with the peace offerings, which again is this communion between me and God kind of thing that we talked about earlier. Here, the fire on the altar that is supposed to be kept burning indicates that the people, again, were attended on God at all times in the sanctuary. We want to maintain this relationship. It expresses a continual devotion. Again, those sorts of ideas. So they were very conscious of the, again, visual, symbolic value of certain acts, in this case, not having the fire go out, to message theology. Very, very conscious of that. Let's go down to verse 18. Again, we just want to keep moving through the chapter here. We have here, every male among the children of Aaron may eat of it. It's specifically talking about food offerings. I have the verse prior to that. I have given it as a portion of my food offerings. It is a thing most holy, like the sin offering and the guilt offering. So this is about, again, part of the offering that's consumed. So every male among the children of Aaron may eat of it. Children of Aaron, again, they're talking about the priesthood, as decreed forever throughout your generations from the Lord's food offerings. And here's the line I want to focus on. Whatever touches them shall become holy. Now, I actually think, here's the reason I bring this up. I think this is actually a mistranslation. It creates the impression of, you know, whoever touches one of these offerings is going to be all of a sudden become holy. And we've talked before about the concept of holiness doesn't necessarily mean a moral quality, but it's a state of sanctity, a state of ritual purity. And Levine says, let me just quote Levine here. I think his little section on this is kind of interesting. And I agree with him. I think what he says makes sense here. He says that we ought to translate this instead of saying whatever touches them shall become holy. Levine says, rather, anyone who is to touch these must be holy or in a holy state. And the issue is the Hebrew word, the verb here, yikdash. Now that, it's a, again, for those who know Hebrew, this is an imperfect form, imperfect conjugation. And the imperfects have a bit of a flexibility to them. It can denote an event ongoing. It can denote an event that hasn't happened yet, shall be, you know, something. It can also denote something that must occur, must be. Again, you can translate an imperfect conjugation form in a variety of ways. And Levine is saying, look, it makes more sense to say that whoever touches these must be in a holy state, must be holy. And here's his explanation. He says, similar statements pertaining to the sanctity of the altar occur in Exodus 29 and Exodus 30, specifically Exodus 29:37 and Exodus 30:29. The problem of interpretation concerns the verb yikdash. Does it mean will become holy as a result of contact with a sanctified substance or object? Or does it mean must be in a holy state? before being allowed to come into contact with a sacred substance or object. So that's the issue. Several scholars, he says, most notably Menachem Haran, have argued for the former. Haran has formulated a theory of contagious holiness, according to which the sanctity of holy objects and substances is communicated or conducted to all that come into contact with them. Now, Levine's going to disagree with that, and I'm on Levine's side of this. He says, although the verb kadash itself often connotes resulting holiness, it is more likely that here it refers to what must occur prior to contact with the sacred. Our verse simply means that only consecrated persons, only persons who are in a state of holiness, may have contact with sacrificial materials, a notion that reinforces the opening of the verse, again, which says that only Aaronic priests may partake of the sacrifices. Similarly, in Exodus 29:37 and 30:29, the sense is that only consecrated persons may have contact with the altar. In fact, there are indications that holiness was not regarded as contagious at all, unlike impurity, which was thought to be highly contagious or highly communicable. This contrast is brought out clearly in Haggai 2:11-13. I'll read part of that. It says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, ask the priests about the law. If someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy?" The priests answered and said, "No." Then Haggai said, "If someone who is unclean by contact with a dead body touches any of these, does it become unclean?" The priest answered and said, "Yes, it does become unclean." So Haggai 2 actually makes the point that Levine is arguing for. Look, there's no such thing as contagious holiness, while there is such a thing as contagious impurity. So it's best to read Leviticus 6:18 as saying, whatever touches, again, stuff that's associated with the sacrifice or the altar must already be holy, must be sanctified. So again, I wanted to address that because the ESV and other translations typically render this as though you could, the priest could sort of touch something and become holy by it. Again, that isn't actually what's going on here. It doesn't make sense when compared with other scripture. Only people who were in a state of ritual purity, quote unquote holiness, could touch these things. And again, think about it. We're talking about food offerings. Okay, who today gets to touch the food offering? We all do, because we're all priests, okay? Again, if you're, put yourself in the context. If you're a first century Jew, you know, you're getting exposed to Christianity, apostolic teaching, and along comes Paul or somebody else, or Peter, you know, use the language as well, that we're all priests. We're a community of priests, the priesthood of the believer. It was just something totally new to them. Because again, there were these two classes, and you know, frankly, if I could, you know, be so bold here, and I'm not saying this is a moral evil or something like that, but there are a lot of churches today, a lot of denominations who maintain firmly a distinction between the clergy and the laity, and one of the ways they do it is who gets to handle the sacred meal stuff, or even positionally. Think about maybe a certain churches you've been in where the priest is separated from the congregation by a rail or, you know, some other piece of furniture or something like that, that they're actually set off or cut off or again, kind of, I don't want to use the word quarantine because that's a little bit silly here. It has the wrong connotation, but you get the idea. They're separated from the laity just in terms of the way the church itself is laid out. Again, having this distinction between clergy and laity, whereas if you were in the first century and you're reading, again, Peter's comments and Paul's comments about participating in the sacred meal and being a believer priest and the presence of God isn't something that you can't tread on, it's in you, okay? These ideas were quite contrastive to what they had grown up with as Jews and frankly, even Gentiles, because Gentile systems of sacrifice are also going to have this real strict distinction between priest and laity, priest and congregation, against those who are sanctified and those who are not, or who sort of need some sort of special permission, against some special sanctification to approach sacred space. Those distinctions are demolished in New Testament theology. And I'm not saying that churches that still do this, you know, they're, you know, committing some sort of moral evil, because, you know, in a neutral way, in a neutral setting, the thought could be, again, I can't think the thoughts of any particular priest or minister in any particular denomination. But the thought is, again, to teach the congregation that there's a distinction between holy ground and non-holy ground. And when we're talking about, you know, the quote unquote, the elements, you know, of the Lord's Supper, that's special, that's something that's, you know, has a sacred feel toward a sacred, you know, property to it. Again, I'm not endorsing the language. I'm just trying to communicate what the idea is, but that isn't something where we just let our kids run around, you know, after the service, because we want to teach people that this is holy stuff. This is a holy act. You know, there's holiness, and then there's, you know, something that isn't sort of, there's space that isn't used to perform, you know, sacred rituals or to do sacred things, even like preaching. You know, I've been in some non-liturgical churches, Baptist churches, for instance, where they were very strict or very insistent on not having, again, kids after the service or something like that, just run up on the, you know, where the pulpit is, because, you know, that's where the preaching happens. That's where the pastor does his thing. That's where we baptize people behind there in the baptistry. So that's not just normal space in this building we call our church. It's something special. So they wanted to, again, teach these ideas. So I think denominations, you know, who have this sort of mental distinguishing, or, and even, again, more than that, even physical distinguishing, you know, trying to teach, you know, their congregation, you know, to not, you know, treat that space up there where the preaching happens as normative, as just everyday, as common. Again, I could look at that and say, well, yeah, that's a worthwhile lesson to teach perhaps. And, you know, I don't think it's anything sinister or bad. So I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression here. But what I am saying is, when you have the first century church, they don't have fancy buildings. They don't have temples. They met house to house. You know, nobody's building an altar in a house and saying, don't let your kids walk over that part. They're not doing that. These distinctions in the apostolic church, church of the first century, were just not there. There was commonality because we were all believer priests, and we all get to partake of the Lord's table, the sacred meal, again, and the logic that went to it. We all have access to God. Okay, we all are, you know, on equal footing because of the blood of Christ, because it sanctifies us. It makes us fit to occupy sacred space by definition. And we are sacred space because the Spirit of God, the same Spirit that inhabited and dwelled in the tabernacle and the temple, lives in us. And so these trappings of modern church didn't have a place in the initial church. Now, we can talk about, it's really a subject for a whole other podcast, maybe even a different podcast, somebody else's podcast. But this whole way that we approach doing church today to a first century convert, somebody who's just glad to find another believer and, hey, can I hole up here for a few days because our opponents just trashed my house or something like that, or under persecution in Rome. And again, they can't be so public about it in certain contexts in the early church. And they don't have these things. What we do would have been quite foreign to them, potentially even offensive. You know, it depends on how they were thinking about it and really how they're presented, how they would have been presented. But again, I'm just hoping you get that distinction, that there's this logic that sort of goes with all things in common, participating in the sacred meal. That when we look at Leviticus, again, when we have Leviticus in our head, we can see some of the theological messaging and really the power of it in the New Testament era when these sort of ecclesiastical walls are torn down. And again, there are lots of historical reasons why church is done the way it's done now. And again, we don't need to go into that, just to make the point that, you know, this is something really worth thinking about. Something that a first century Christian, especially if they had a strong Jewish background, but again, even Gentiles, would have just noticed right away. Let's go down to another thing here. Chapter 6, we're still in. Let's go down to verse 26. Again, just a little snippet here. I'll go back to verse 24 where it starts the section. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law of the sin offering. In the place where the burnt offering is killed, shall the sin offering be killed before the Lord. It is most holy. Here's verse 26. The priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. In a holy place it shall be eaten, in the court of the tent of meeting. Whatever touches its flesh shall be holy. Again, here we go back to that sort of thing. And again, agreeing with Levine, the point of that is the person who touches it must already be holy, must be sanctified. And when any of its blood is splashed on a garment, you shall wash that on which it was splashed in a holy place. And the earthenware vessel in which it is boiled shall be broken. Just destroy it. But if it is boiled in a bronze vessel, that shall be scoured and rinsed with water. And you say, well, what in the world is going on here? Well, to quote Levine again, he says, should any sacrificial blood stain a garment, that garment must be laundered, because it would be improper if any blood of the sacrifice was not used for its only legitimate purpose. You can't just have the blood of the sacrifice out there willy-nilly on other stuff, because the blood of the sacrifice was there for a specific application. It was to be used very specifically for a particular thing, and to have any of it not used for that thing or that procedure, you know, was bad. You know, we can't do that. That's an improper use of the sacrifice. So Levine continues, the blood of the sin offering was to be placed on the horns of the altar, and the rest poured down on its side, as ordained in Leviticus 4:25. That's what you do with the blood. If any of it gets on a garment, that has to be washed on sacred space. Okay, we just read the verses again, because you can't allow the blood of the offering to be put to any other use. And you can't just let it go out on non-sacred space. I mean, it's a way of enforcing this idea, the difference between the sacred, you know, and the profane. Now, what about the, you know, breaking up the earthenware? Well, that's because earthenware, I mean, think about it, was to be destroyed. And the metal, if you boiled it in a metal container, then that just had to be washed. But earthenware is more porous. In fact, it's quite porous. And so the earthenware, you know, a piece of pottery, again, made with, you know, clay, would absorb particles of the flesh and, of course, the blood that had been boiled, you know, it had been used for boiling. So you can't have, again, the risk of having any part of the flesh or the blood go somewhere else or be put to a different use. And you can't really get it out of earthenware, so you have to destroy it. If you're using a, you know, again, a bronze vessel, you know, something like that, hey, that you can just wash. Again, do it on sacred space, but that you can wash and rinse with water. But the earthenware stuff, if that's what you're using, you just have to destroy it. Again, it's this idea, again, teaching by, you know, physical object lesson, that the blood of the sacrifice is for this place only and is for this use only, that sort of thing. Now, in chapter 7, just a couple of things there I want to mention real briefly. In chapter 7, verse 11, we hit some language that's a bit new. It says, this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings that one may offer to the Lord. If he offers it for a thanksgiving, then he shall offer with thanksgiving sacrifice unleavened loaves mixed with oil, unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and loaves of fine flour well mixed with oil. I wanted to comment just on the thanksgiving language. So we have the zavach, todah, thanksgiving sacrifice or thanksgiving offering. Now, technically, in the immediate context, or at least in the context of the first few chapters of Leviticus, this would refer to the sacrifice, a sacrifice specifically discussed in chapter 3, namely a, you know, sheep or goat, either male or female. Nevertheless, though, this ritual that involves the grain offerings, and you can't do it with, you know, leavened material as well. This ritual, again, as mentioned here in chapter 6, really is, again, marking the peace offering here as something you would do to express gratitude to God. And oftentimes in the Old Testament, interestingly enough, you will see offerings classified or labeled as thanksgiving offerings when they are sort of, when you're on the other side of escaping from some danger or some misfortune. Amos 4:5 is a verse that Levine brings up in his discussion of this. It's kind of interesting. He says, Amos 4:5, which I'll quote here, offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving of that which is leavened, and proclaim freewill offerings. Publish them, for so you love to do, O people of Israel, declares the Lord God. So he, I mean, it's a negative comment again, but Amos is pointing to this notion of people doing what they're doing to sort of avoid danger or avoid misfortune. And again, they're doing it not necessarily correctly, but it's sort of symptomatic that, hey, we better do this stuff, you know, so that we can avoid bad stuff that's going to happen. Well, look whose book it is. It's Amos. Okay. Amos, you know, ministered just before what? You know, the destruction of the northern kingdom. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting verse because here you have, again, people doing a certain thing, not with in the right way or the right heart attitude, but like the prophet's running around here saying that we're all, you know, we're going to get killed, we're going to get taken into exile and all this stuff. So let's just do some of these offerings and take care of business here. Well, that, again, isn't the way it's going to work. It's just kind of an interesting reference that they thought, again, they wore the use of this offering or performance of this offering warded off danger. But typically the Thanksgiving offering is something that you would do when God did deliver you after the fact, not, again, to sort of use it as some kind of weird talisman, you know, to keep bad things from happening. You know, so kind of a superstitious kind of thing. Verse 30, last thing here that we'll mention specifically here in Leviticus 6 and 7. Let's go, we'll just take it from verse 28. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the people of Israel saying, whoever offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his offering to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hands shall bring the Lord's offerings. He shall bring the fat with the breast and the breast that the breast may be waved as a wave offering before the Lord. The priest shall burn the fat on the altar, and the breast shall be for Aaron and his sons. Okay, I bring this up because here we have another new term, the wave offering. Hebrew is tenufah, which is from the verb hanaf, to lift or to raise. And basically, this was a gesture that was used to sort of show God what you were going to offer, show God the offering, sort of with the implication that when he sees it, he will accept it. Again, it's kind of interesting because now we have, again, this added gesture. Like, well, does that mean that they didn't believe that God could see what they were doing? No, this is a human gesture. Again, part of the ritual that you are presenting something to God. And so it's not a statement of God's lack of omniscience. It's just, again, something you would do so that people could see that you are, again, exposing what you're doing to God, and he's going to accept it. Now, I also mention this because the order of this procedure that we just read has some significance. The priest, again, is entitled to what? To what part of it? The breast, mentioned in verse 30. And he's also going to get the right thigh, but only after God's share of the offering, you know, the fatty portions had been burned on the altar. Remember in previous sacrifices, we talked about God getting his portion first. Well, in 1 Samuel 2, this is what the sons of Eli were doing to violate the sacrificial system. In 1 Samuel 2, 15 and 17, we read, moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now. And if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young man was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. So the sons of Eli, the priest of Shiloh, were not obeying the law that we just read, and, you know, lots of other things too. They were taking their portions of the sacrifices from the cooking pots even before the altar sacrifice had been performed by the priest. You know, they were clearly violating Leviticus, and so they're taking what they want first before God gets what is due to him. So they're violating the specific procedure. Again, we're kind of familiar with the story of Eli's sons and how wicked they were, but I just thought I would mention this because it does sort of dovetail with what they were doing. The specific thing that God was angry at them for is actually mentioned, again, procedurally, in this chapter, in this place. So that's what I wanted to hit on in Leviticus 6 and 7. I think for us, again, the big takeaway here is going back to how certain New Testament language would have been perceived by early Christians, especially early Jewish Christians. But again, I'm including even the Gentiles in here because they had this strong distinction between priest and laity, priest and clergy and laity. And all of that kind of thinking, you know, you're in the fledgling beginning, you know, church in Jerusalem. You don't have buildings. You're meeting from house to house. You know, you're predominantly, of course, we went through the book of Acts here in the Naked Bible, you know, a while back. it begins in a Jewish context. And here you have the apostles saying, look, we're going to partake of this sacred meal, all of us, to remember the Lord and his sacrifice. In the night he was betrayed, the Lord said, take, eat. This is my body broken for you. This is the blood of the covenant. You know, this wine is my blood, the blood of the covenant. Again, these are elements of a sacred meal. And it's not just the priests, you know, who are partaking of this. It's everybody, because we are all priests. We are now a priesthood of believers, because the Spirit of God dwells in us. Again, these ideas and the theological ideas that from which they were derived about how the sacrifice of Jesus made everyone, of course, initially Jewish, but then also Gentile, which was shocking, fit for sacred space, fit to be a priest of Yahweh, fit to partake of the sacred meal. It would have just shocked them. And I think it was a powerful statement of God's attitude toward his people. It's really moving away from sort of a national entity, I catch my wording here, a national entity back to a family. And again, the imagery was important, and the theology that was attached to it certainly important.
All right. Well, good deal. Mike, isn't the chapter 7 kind of the last of the rules, instructions of it?
Yeah, we're going to get in chapter 8 and chapter 9, you're going to get sort of the sanctifying of those who would be priests. Again, the procedures that were done to them to make them fit to start the ball rolling, you know, that sort of thing. And then we're going to get into lots of different laws where we're going to get distinctions between ritual purity and moral purity and that sort of thing.
Okay. Looking forward to that. Well, Mike, I'd want to switch gears a bit and ask you how the Unseen Realm is doing and how it's being received in the academic world.
Yeah, I mean, the reviews have been really, really good. If for those who want to sort of keep up with reviews, if you go to the companion website for the book, which is moreunseenrealm.com, and you click on reviews, there's a tab for reviews. There's somebody here inside the building gave me a piece of code that collects reviews and comments about the book from different, you know, social media outlets. And that updates in real time. So you can sort of keep up with, you know, what's being posted out there on the web. But I've had a number of people email me, you know, professors at different schools that are going to require the book and really are liking the content. And I think you're not always going to have everybody agree with every point. And we know that from the beginning, but they find the book really stimulating. It's like, you know, this, I've had people tell me, you know, this is a book that every seminary student should read. Agree with everything or not, everybody should read this because it's just so packed, you know, with information, sort of, you know, gives you all these connection points. And that's gratifying, you know, because that's really, you know, frankly, what I was trying to do in the book, get people to look at scripture that way and to have professors tell me that we're definitely going to require this is pretty gratifying. So I'm happy with it.
So how does this affect current theology? I mean, what's the process in the academic world and changing theology? Is it going to be taught in seminary now? I mean, can you walk me through that?
Yeah, it's up to the individual professor. Professors typically get to assign their own books. I mean, you'll get a few circumstances like with 100 level classes where a school will want the professors to use the same books. So everybody sort of starts out at the same place. But if you're doing elective theology classes and Old Testament theology classes, you can do what you want. And professors are going to do that. And, you know, I've had several tell me this is what we're going to do. I've had one, in fact, actually tell me that for their theology classes, you know, the so to speak, 100 level classes, that they're actually going to require it for all of them across the board. So you get some of both, but that's typically what happens. Professors assign what they want, and you know, they want to expose their students, you know, to, you know, whatever the content is, and they'll do that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, seminaries ultimately, you know, at least many of them, are about, you know, perpetuating their own, you know, Christian subcontext and subculture. And they're, you know, this isn't going to make anybody who's in a Reformed seminary say, oh, you know, we should just ditch our Reformed theology and go to that. I mean, that's pie in the sky and frankly unnecessary. There's a reason why I'm denominationally independent and denominationally apathetic, because good biblical theology can operate in any denominational context. I mean, you're going to have distinctives, sure, but what I'm doing in the Unseen Realm is really applicable anywhere. And I get emails from, I mean, I've gotten emails from Catholics, from, you know, people in Presbyterian churches, Baptist churches, Anglican churches, charismatic churches that either read the previous draft or now the book that say we're so glad for it. So it has broad appeal, again, regardless of the denominational situation.
What are some of the criticisms you've gotten?
Well, I haven't. Let me try to think if I can get a think of a specific one.
Has one group or another given you more blowback than the others?
Well,
there
was one. There's one on Amazon, you know, where the guy reading it that says he's warning fellow Calvinists, that I'm going to say non-Calvinistic things, because Heiser is an Arminian. But that's actually a good illustration, because look at that statement. It tells you that the person would have difficulty reading something and not filtering it through denominational labels, or preconceived labels. It's funny to me, because if I say something John Calvin wouldn't, oh, then I must be an Arminian. If I say something John Calvin would, oh, then I must be a Calvinist. I mean, people have difficulty thinking about theology, dare I say, just using the text, just caring about the text, and not where a conclusion falls in the nomenclature, in the categories, in the systems. But that's okay, because I know that's where a lot of people are going to be at. Doesn't matter, to me, but what I, again, personally find gratifying is that I get responses that are very positive from basically every denomination. And I find that gratifying, because what it tells me, again, is that the content, at the end of the day, does not derive from or support any one tradition. And it shouldn't. Biblical theology shouldn't just be sort of cloistered away in one tradition or processed, through one tradition. And what I'm hoping is that people will start to see, they'll actually spend time on sites and look at the reviews and say, well, gosh, the Calvinist over here likes it, and I'm an Arminian and I like it too. Maybe we shouldn't really be pigeonholing theology in these systems. Maybe we should just sort of start thinking more about the text and the interconnections in the text, and not care so much about, again, the labels and the nomenclature and all this sort of thing. I mean, that long term, that's what I hope, happens, to get more people who just think outside those boxes and see, because people in other boxes like this book just like they do, and maybe it'll help people think that way.
Yeah, I'm going to call that, relying on the text, common sensism. I just coined that right there.
Yeah, there you go.
Common sensism.
Good trademark.
Yeah.
So I think in the future, other than having professors use it in class, there are some schools. I have two specifically that a conversation has begun about having an event at the school, that would be sort of part of the school's calendar, which would, get lots of students there, going out and talking about the book, at a school. So there are two of those things that, are at the very beginning of the conversation. But beyond that, when I hit the academic meetings in November, I know a number of the people who are sort of the society officers, people who set up the convention and have to do all the grunt work there. And it's very common, to ask them for special sessions and say, hey, can we put this on the calendar for next year and have a call to papers? Maybe something like, discussion of Mike Heiser's Unseen Realm or something like that. And then people would submit, they would see that next year and they would submit papers, and I would be, myself and probably three or four other people would look at the proposals. But it would be nice to do that, because then you get other scholars and other, doctoral students and seminary students sort of interacting with the material. And out of that, you would naturally get new thinking, you'd get, constructive, criticism, you'd get, boy, I love this because of this other thing over here that I'm working on. And I mean, last year I came across two or three papers doing divine counsel stuff in ways that I hadn't really thought about, that were just outstanding papers. And that's the kind of thing I hope to have happen on a broader academic level, something bigger than just one school, to get people interacting with it. Because that way I learn something, and I have more material to put in a second book and that sort of thing. So ultimately, we hope to start that ball rolling in November with the academic societies.
And you'll find out if that is going to be approved or.
Yeah, it wouldn't take too long after I propose it. I would think maybe a couple months. I don't know what their calendar is for when they make those decisions specifically. I just know who the people who are the people who make those decisions.
I hope that happens for 2016 because I think it's in San Antonio, Texas.
I'll be able
to attend that.
Did you look ahead? Because I don't know that it is, but I know San Antonio is coming up soon.
Yeah, I think it's next year. This year is San Diego, and then the year after.
Well, this year is Atlanta.
Atlanta, that's right.
So, you know.
And then next year is San Antonio, I believe.
Yeah, 2017, so, yeah.
That would be good. And then that would be
2016. You're right, yeah.
And this year, we're aiming, hopefully, to have some good interviews out of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I am going to take my recording device with me to the conference. And chat with people. I mean, I'll do, you know, just stuff I just think people will be interesting. I'll run into John Walton and say, "Hey, John, you know, give me 5 minutes. Here are my three questions." And because you run into people all the time. I talk to them every year, but it'd just be kind of nice to have a recorder there just to chit chat, and then maybe get into this other stuff too.
Yeah, it'll be
fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. All right, Mike, was there anything else you'd like to discuss for the show?
No, I think that's it for this time.
And next week, we're going to be doing our sixth question and answer show.
Mm-hmm.
So be looking forward to that. I promise everybody, I still have your questions in the queue. Mike, we probably have enough to do at least 4 or 5 question and answer shows. So at least we'll chip away at it and get our sixth one under our belt next week. So stay tuned for that. I promise you, we're whittling away at it. And Mike, I guess with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.